We're reading Wave this month on the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. It's Sonali Dhirniagala's gripping memoir of what happened to her family when the tsunami struck Sri Lanka in 2004 and how she tried to cope with her enormous grief and its aftermath. Pick up a copy of Wave, read it along with us, and then the author will be here on February 28th. You can join the conversation now by asking a question about the book on our show page at WNYC.org. On May 3, 1946, a Japanese nationalist named Okawa Shume entered the courtroom of the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal and slapped former Prime Minister Tojo on the top of his head. Newspaper headlines called it the slap heard round the world, and the court wondered whether Okawa was insane. Major Daniel Jaffe was asked to find out, and now his grandson, Eric Jaffe, has taken a look at both men's personal histories and the political landscape leading up to the trial in his new book called A Curious Madness, An American Combat Psychiatrist, A Japanese War Crime Suspect, and An Unsolved Mystery from World War II. It's published by Scribner. We're very pleased that it brings Eric Jaffe back to our show. Hello.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me back.
After World War II, the Allies indicted 28 Japanese men for Class A war crimes in the International Military Trial for the Far East, or what was called the Tokyo Trials. What qualifies as a Class A war crime?
Yeah, some of them actually even called it Japan's Nuremberg because people knew Nuremberg better. So
was it similar?
Yes, actually, in many ways. The 28 Class A defendants were the kind of heads of state, military leaders, and former prime ministers who were considered most responsible for Japan's imperial march, its kind of rise to war. The star defendant was Tojo Hideki, who had been prime minister, of course, when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. And there was only a single civilian on trial among the 28, and that was Okawa Shume.
And why was he brought up on charges?
Okawa was considered by the Allies to be the brain trust, the civilian brain trust of Japanese militarism. He was described often as the mind that kind of directed the country's military might, and he did this by popularizing an ideology that he called Asianism or Pan-Asianism. And the way this worked was that the nations of East Asia would unite under Japanese leadership, and they would oppose the Western powers, and in doing so, they would really kind of reconfigure world order. This was kind of Okawa's ideology that the Allies, of course, argued pushed Japan toward a kind of more military culture.
And he did this as a reporter, or as a journalist, or as a radio personality?
He was an author. He wore a lot of hats, actually. He was an author. He wrote best-selling books. During Japan's kind of march to war, he also worked at think tanks, and he was very close with a lot of the young military officers who kind of pushed Japanese leaders toward a more militant policy.
So, as we saw in Rwanda later, not everyone who was actually in a position of power was considered a major factor in what had happened in that genocide. He was seen as somebody who was the man behind the ideology?
He was seen as the man who really popularized this ideology that eventually kind of led Japan on a collision course with the United States.
So I would have thought that he would have admired Tojo. Tojo did what he wanted. So why did he slap him on the top of his head?
Well, they were friends, although they had a falling out when Tojo was rising to power himself. That's a little bit of a different story. But the first day of the trial at the arraignment, Okawa was really acting strangely. I mean, he came in wearing a totally inappropriate outfit. It was described as a pajama top. He sat down at the dock directly behind Tojo, and he started muttering gibberish. He started kind of fidgeting in his chair. He started taking that pajama top and rolling it down his sleeves and arm. And eventually he leans forward and he slaps Tojo right in the middle of the trial and catches everybody by surprise.
And what was the court's reaction?
Well, of course, there was quite a commotion in the court. And the judge's response, the Chief Justice's response, was to remove Okawa from the courtroom, and to have one psychiatrist from each side, Japanese and the Allied side, evaluate him and see whether he was competent to stand trial.
And your grandfather was the Allied psychiatrist.
That's right. My grandfather evaluated him from the Allied side. And what happened was, at the time, both psychiatrists came back and said, Okawa cannot stand trial. He's essentially insane. And so the court kind of removed him, let him wait out the trial at a mental hospital. And when the verdicts finally came down, seven of the Japanese were hung, including Tojo, and the rest began prison sentences. And Okawa left a couple days later, left the mental hospital, got to go home, and was the only one of the original 28 to go free.
And many people wondered whether he was faking it.
Yeah, the timing of the onset of his insanity right as the trial began and the timing of its recovery right as the sentences were being handed out was too perfect for some people to believe, and there was a lot of speculation that he had faked it.
Was this a cloud that hung over your grandfather?
My grandfather didn't talk much about the war when I was growing up, but toward the end of his life, he kind of prepared these memoirs that described his service. And by far the most fascinating part to me was this description of his encounter at the Tokyo trial with Okawa Shume. And beyond that, what was really fascinating to me is that he knew some historians had kind of doubted his own conclusions.
So was it your intention to understand why he had made that decision when you set out to write this book?
Well, as I started my research, I found a lot of documents that kind of suggested Okawa's side of the story. I mean, I found a CIA memo saying that probably he had faked his insanity. There was one of the justices later came out in an interview saying Okawa probably deceived the court. Okawa himself gave an interview saying I was fine. So there were all these historical voices kind of coming to Okawa's side of this mystery, but there weren't many coming to my grandfather's side, least of which being my grandfather, who never got to publish his memoirs.
My guest is Eric Jaffe, whose latest book is A Curious Madness, an American combat psychiatrist, a Japanese war crime suspect, and an unsolved mystery from World War II. The Japan had gone through an amazing transformation since near the end of the 19th century, the Meiji era. Modernized so well that it actually started winning wars against Western powers within 20 years or so. Some people thought this was great, and others saw this as a disaster. What was the situation with our subject here? Was Okawa one of the people who said, we're making a big mistake?
Right. Japanese society was really split on whether or not to embrace Westernization. Obviously, the government did, and as an official policy, the country really modernized in the Western model, but there was a large kind of subculture of people like Okawa who really wanted to go back to traditional roots and to have Japan really be part of Asia as opposed to part of the West. And that was kind of the kernel of this ideology that he later embraced about Asianism.
So how did he react to Japan's role in World War I?
He was very much... He didn't like the fact that Japan kind of allied with Great Britain during World War I because he was very much in favor of India's rights. He saw India as part of this East Asian coalition that the eastern part of the civilization should form, and so he didn't like what Great Britain was doing in India and opposed Japan's partnership with them.
What was his take on what Japan did once it went into China and started things like the rape of Nanking?
Right. Well, that's where it gets interesting in delving into Okawa's psyche, because he really pushed for Japan to establish itself on the mainland. He wanted a Japanese presence in Manchuria. He saw this as kind of its divine right to have this presence here and help establish the union of Asian nations under Japanese leadership.
But he didn't see it as neocolonialism?
Well, he did kind of see it as neocolonialism. He didn't see that as a bad thing. He saw the United States having its own interests in China as well and didn't see it as any different and worried that if Japan didn't plant itself in that part of the world, it would be pushed out of its own neighborhood.
In the 1920s, Okawa and others were predicting a war between the United States and Japan. He said it will be a war between day and night.
Yeah, Okawa.
I guess the United States was night.
The United States was the stars, and Japan was the sun, and the day was going to conquer the night. He was a very very literary fellow. And this was in 1925, he actually made this prophecy that Japan and the United States would clash in what he called a clash of the civilizations. And once the war ended, it was this prophecy that kind of really put him on the Allied radar to be included in the Tokyo trial.
Now, on the other side, there was growing fear in the West of what was called the Yellow Peril, a definite kind of racism.
Right.
Were the Japanese aware of this?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the things that bothered Okawa and his followers. Things like the 1924 Immigration Act, in which the United States decided to let no Japanese immigrate into the country, even though they could have allowed a ratio, just a very small number of Japanese, like they were with other European countries. And Okawa saw that as a quite disrespectful and unequitable act.
And he assumed that when there was a war, it would involve a lot of nations, and then the dust would settle, and Asia would come out victorious?
That's right. He certainly thought Japan would emerge in this clash of the civilizations, and in doing so, he thought he would rewrite world order and hopefully Japan could kind of call its own shots.
Now, your grandfather had worked with Walter Friedman, who was dubbed the godfather of lobotomy. Now, I don't think there are too many people who think lobotomy was a good idea.
Right.
Did he write anything about that in his memoirs?
So my grandfather kind of encountered madness. He was really surrounded by madness throughout the course of his life. I mean, when he was a young man, his mother had a terribly tragic breakdown that he had to witness. She was in and out of mental hospitals her whole life. And when he went to medical school, he decided to study the mind, and he did study with Walter Freeman at George Washington. And of course, now we see lobotomy as a kind of see it in a terribly negative light. But at the time, it was kind of part of this package of bold psychiatric treatments that was at least trying to help intervene as opposed to sweep the problem into asylums.
In fact, the inventor of lobotomy, a Portuguese doctor, wound up winning the Nobel Prize.
He did, and Freeman changed the name to lobotomy from leucotomy, actually, to try to differentiate himself.
Was he working as a psychiatrist with the military? Were people noticing things like PTSD at that time?
Right. So when the war began, he eventually got called up as a combat psychiatrist, and it was a very unique position, a very rare one during the war. There was only one per division. That's one per every 15,000 or so men. And the combat psychiatrist's role was to be stationed at the front lines, right at the helm of combat, and to treat mental casualties right there to help them kind of recover as quickly as possible. They didn't call it PTSD. They called it combat fatigue at the time.
Mm-hmm. Then Japan surrendered after the U.S. dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What was Okawa's reaction at the time?
Well, Okawa, I think, writes in his diary that 40 or 50 years of Asianism has come to an end now. So he was obviously distraught at this, but he was torn throughout the war. His conscience was never clear. He kind of realized what he had done at some point, and you could make the argument that he started to break down then.
What evidence did the Allies use to build a case against him?
Well, the Allies really wanted to amass documentary evidence as much as they could against the Tokyo trial suspects.
Which lasted 2.5 years.
Yeah, which was a problem later on. But Okawa, having been such a prolific writer and actually having been arrested for an attempted coup, he had a mountain of documentary evidence kind of showing what his influence had been over society. So he was one of the easy ones for the Allies to pinpoint.
The lawyer who interrogated him was from Kentucky, Hugh B. Helm. What was his conclusion about Okawa?
Helm was quite convinced that Okawa was a key instigator of the war. In fact, one of the people he interviewed felt that Okawa was even more important to it than Tojo because Okawa's influence had begun so early on, you know, in the early 1920s.
And you say some Japanese saw Okawa as an ideological instigator and among the biggest criminals of them all.
Sure. After the Tokyo trial began, it was quite common for members of the Japanese public to try to pin all of the responsibility on these 28 leaders and kind of absolve themselves.
Did you get a sense from your grandfather's writings whether he had any political biases?
he never really gets into that. One of the things I found most interesting about writing the book was my grandfather was such a quiet man that it was very hard to kind of understand his thoughts and feelings. At times, I even felt closer to Okow in a sense because he wrote so much. He really let you know exactly what he was thinking and feeling, and my grandfather was not the same way.
You say that one of the reasons Okawa was released was that the Allies were tired of all the trials, the Nuremberg trials and the Tokyo trials. After 2.5 years, they said, let's not pursue this any further.
Right. Well, Nuremberg, you know, was just the first of a dozen trials that followed it. And after the Tokyo trial, many assumed there would be similar subsequent trials. And during these trials, maybe we could look at some of the problems that had happened in China and other parts of the world. But as you mentioned, the Tokyo trial went on for 2.5 years, and I think people were just kind of tired of it.
How long did your grandfather practice psychiatry?
After the war, my grandfather came back and he started a private practice as a psychoanalyst, and he continued
the talking cure.
That's right. He made it a profession. His quiet nature.
And you have no sense of whether his ideas about psychiatry changed over the years?
Not much. He was pretty devoted to psychoanalysis by the time he was nearing the end of his practice.
Eric Jaffe's previous book, The King's Best Highway, The Lost History of the Boston Post Road, The Route That Made America, was the book that brought him to our show previously. Mm-hmm. And now a very different kind of book. In fact, the only thing that has in common with the previous book is that you wrote it.
That's right.
It's called A Curious Madness, an American combat psychiatrist, a Japanese war crime suspect, and an unsolved mystery from World War II. It is published by Scribner. And I thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you.